Popcast is supported by Stella Artois. These days, truly memorable moments are rare. That's why this summer, Stella Artois wants to inspire everyone to host one to remember. Whether it's a midday soiree, a rooftop happy hour, or a dinner under the stars, through thoughtful details, any moment can become an unforgettable occasion. Because memories are made when great food, great friends, and Stella Artois come together. Stella Artois, host one to remember.
Penn State World Campus offers more than 125 graduate and undergraduate degree and certificate programs that you can work towards from anywhere in the world. Getting more info is easy. Visit worldcampusinfo.com. Penn State World Campus's convenient, flexible online format is a great option if you want to advance your career or start fresh in a new field. Learn how Penn State World Campus can help you reach your educational goals by visiting worldcampusinfo.com. Penn State World Campus, a world of possibilities. Online.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your We Are Who We Are of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I'm proud of who I am. No more monsters, I can breathe again. And you said that I was done. Well, you were wrong, and now the best is yet to come. 'Cause I can make it on my own. I don't need you. I find a strength I've never known.
Everybody drop a knee. We're praying. I'm back after a week off. I'm very sad to have missed Fishcast, but Karen Gans held me down. Karen, thank you.
You're welcome, John.
But we're back with a new jam this week. A long jam. The Jam of Kesha. That was Kesha's Praying, which we opened with. Praying is a song off of the new Kesha album, which is called Rainbow, which was just released, and perhaps by the time you hear this, will be the number one album in the country. This was perhaps an unlikely set of events, or a series of events, rather, for Kesha, given some of the legal troubles that she has been facing over the last couple of years, to talk about Kesha both from a legal perspective and from an aesthetic perspective. I am joined by the New York Times Pop Music Dream Team, pop music editor Kara Gans.
Hello again.
That's true. That's two intros, but that's solid.
I'll take it.
So nice we introed you twice. Pop music reporter Joe Coscarelli.
I'm here as well.
Just one intro for Joe.
Joe is present.
Just one intro for Joe.
That's all right. That's all I need.
You can rewind it and play it again if you need more. So Kesha is back, and I want to open by saying that I thought this album was better than I was expecting it to be. Certainly better than the show that I covered on the comeback tour last year. This has been a long process.
What month was that? It feels like 7 years ago.
I want to say it was last August, maybe. Is that right?
I think it was September. I referenced it in my review.
I saw there was a hyperlink.
There was.
To another World Wide Web page.
I'm a real digitally oriented editor, yeah. John. I don't know if you're aware.
I want to say that was a good example of strong editing.
Strong editing and strong writing, where the editor steps up and takes the album review for the week because we're drowning.
Yes. Yeah. Should we just talk a little bit about last week? Like last week, there was a lot popping. I was traveling last week.
Yeah.
You know, I had to go see Lady Gaga in Tacoma.
Right.
Shouts to all my little monsters in Tacoma.
And Lady Gaga also a supporting role in this whole Kesha drama.
There are a lot of intertwining things. Then I was in Los Angeles for a while working on a secret project. Right. You guys will know about that pretty soon. And taking a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
So because of that, Karen Gans had to step up, host the podcast, and do the album review of the week.
I wonder how much of this will make it to air.
All of it.
All of it. This
like
is
literally
100%.
I love the podcast. So loose.
Literally 100%. Perhaps 120%.
Well, while we mused on that, I was able to confirm that the Kesha show that the three of us attended was indeed last September.
So it's 11 months ago.
Yeah. And well, I mean, this is really the culmination of a three-year arc from when she first filed this civil lawsuit, I believe it was against Sony, and Dr. Luke himself attempting to free herself from a series of contracts because she no longer wished to work with Dr. Luke.
Dr. Luke was, I should say, a well-regarded and popular pop music songwriter and producer who made a lot of hits in the late 2000s and early 2010.
Miley, Katie,
anything ends in a vowel.
Yep.
Probably had a hand in. And Kesha originally, if I'm not mistaken, worked with Luke as a songwriter.
Right.
And so, featured performer.
Yes. So Kesha, as I think, you know, anybody who's been following this saga knows that Kesha is deeply linked to Dr. Luke through a series of contracts that begin when she was an 18-year-old unknown in Nashville. She signed to his production company, KMI, Kaz Money Inc., as an artist. She signed to his publishing prescription songs as a songwriter. Those contracts were amended over the years. She signed more and more contracts with Dr. Luke. Eventually, her services were furnished to Sony Music and RCA and Kemosabe, all sort of under the Sony Music umbrella, but all via Dr. Luke. So anything that Kesha does up to this moment essentially is in business collaboration with Dr. Luke.
Before we actually get into sort of the current moment of Kesha in both sort of legal terms and artistic terms, can we talk about how Kesha arrived at the point of becoming a star, sort of out of nowhere? This all happened in, you know, 2010, maybe 2011 is when the early stuff was going on.
It was 2010.
There you go.
Kesha, yeah, I think she was sort of in this development stage with Dr. Luke for a while where, you know, she thought she was ready to be an artist and he was sort of continuing to refine. He's notoriously
Detail-oriented.
Persnickety?
Some would say perfectionist. Some would say, you know, a controlling monster, as Kesha has said in her lawsuits against him. We first heard her on an uncredited vocal feature on Right Round.
Flow Rida.
Let's listen to a little Right Round.
I mean, it's hard to just start listening to it because I just listen to it constantly on loop. So let's just plug into my own personal aux chord.
Let's do that.
Go in.
Oh, those were the days. Good times. Good times. Shouts to Flo Rida. Shouts to Carol City.
And, you know, what followed from there was like a pretty impressive string of hits. I mean, I listened back to TikTok the other day, which I still think is probably her best song.
Banger.
I like a lot of her songs. TikTok is up there.
But, you know, it's just, I remember hearing it when it came out and it came from nowhere. And it was sort of the beginning of this rap, sing.
White Latrim.
I recall a John Caramonica piece about that.
True story.
I do too. Yes. Yeah. True story. Did you want her to be a rapper or did you want her to be a pop star?
I didn't want it, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if I talked about this the last time we did a Kesha podcast. When I interviewed her, that was around, what was the first release? Animal was the first release?
Yeah.
Animal was the first full length or EP or whatever. So I interviewed her, you know, leading up to that. And we had a whole conversation about whether she was rapping or not. And I think it was maybe before she had either conceptualized herself as such or thought it would be sort of a potentially a positive thing to promote or conceptualize. And I don't want to say we argued over it, but it was definitely – we definitely did not agree.
You're like, I don't want to say we argued over it, but the third song on this album is about me.
I was just very struck because I thought when my initial immediate reaction to it was, oh, this is really savvy. It's like maybe a little dirty, but like it's savvy. This is a smart idea. And I kind of came into the room saying, hey, let's talk about this smart idea. And it was, and the response was not, great, I'd love to talk about this more. The response was, I'm not sure that that's what I'm doing.
Which makes sense in hindsight, right?
Yes, because it makes
now
more sense
we know
back.
Now we know that Kesha, which, so, you know, the sort of unspoken thing that we haven't mentioned is that Kesha claimed that Dr. Luke abused her sexually,
emotionally,
verbally, and that that's why she should be let out of these contracts. And amid these lawsuits, which are contract lawsuits essentially, mm-hmm. but with, you know, some very intense personal details in them.
And there are no criminal
charges. There's no criminal charges ever filed, right? But in these lawsuits, Kesha sort of states that she was forced into this sound, basically, mm-hmm. that she never had any control over her creative destiny, and that she, you know, was given lines that she didn't agree with, that she had mm-hmm. to say, that she, you know, singles were chosen for her, basically, that she was forced by this Svengali figure, Dr. Luke, into the career that was a huge success. I mean, she, you know, she had number one singles, she had number mm-hmm. one albums, she became a big star, and then she sort of disowned that version of herself.
Yeah, and sort of a style vanguard pop star, like a pop star doing what passes for experimental approaches in a mainstream, pop realm,
sure.
but within a mainstream framework.
And it was very playful, which is why some of the allegations, you know, they seem even more striking, that she was living such an intense personal hell that she describes while she was making music that was meant for people, you know. This was around the time when Gaga's Little Monsters and everybody had, like, everyone was conceiving of their fan group as freaks and outsiders, and that they, the pop star, were gathering them together and telling them that it's okay to be who you are and we're going to go to our shows and celebrate. But I will say that, like, going to a lot of early Kesha shows, there was a real fun, playful, giant prop vibe where it really did feel like anything goes, but she also was a great singer.
Yeah.
But, you know, her aesthetic was glitter everywhere, rolling around, kind of dirty.
Yeah, distressed clothing, yeah. sort of like
heavy drinking.
Heavy early yeah. Sunset Strip kind of aesthetic mm-hmm. in the outfits, but like with a mix of like 10% rave, 90% Axl Rose kind of
sequin sleaze
yeah.
vibe.
And she did seem less polished than the people she was competing with at the time,
right.
who were Gaga, Pink, Kelly Clarkson, you know, you name
Katy
it.
Perry.
Katy Perry yeah. in particular, yeah.
Or Taylor, you know, Taylor. Early Taylor. Crossover,
early Taylor.
Early crossover
yeah.
Taylor, for yeah. sure. That's how we first come to know Kesha. And again, this is with the benefit of hindsight, we obviously can look at all that stuff very differently. But that's how we come to know Kesha. And that's the, when you think of Kesha at her pop peak, it's that version of Kesha.
And it's electronic. And which is why
yes.
I think seeing the guitars last year on this tour that she did with this band, The Creepies, sort of her backing band, was guitar based. They're covering rock songs. They're wearing cowboy hats. She wanted to be in a rock band.
But I feel like even back then, if I'm not mistaken, and I may be retroactively imagining this, but I think even in 2010 on YouTube, you could find basically Kesha in a bar singing either with a guitar herself or with
her mom, who's a national songwriter,
yes. or with a guitar accompanist, but basically singing country and rocks and soft to medium hard rock.
Yeah,
songs.
I think yeah. it was always part of her narrative, but it was hard to tell whether it was the sort of authenticity play where it's like, I'm a glossy pop star, but also I love rock music.
You don't know which came first.
Right.
You didn't, at least then, you didn't know which really came first.
Right.
So Kesha, from say 2010 to 2013, had a pretty impressive run.
Yeah, and I would say the first, I don't want to even call it like a crack in the foundation, came after the Newtown massacre, when her song Die Young had recently come out, and she came out publicly to say that she was disavowing the song, that she had been encouraged to record and release it, even though really the lyrics of the song don't have much to do with the small children being massacred. But she was very bothered by the idea that she was promoting an idea that she was telling people to die young.
And that was the first time she sort of raised her hand and said, this wasn't my idea.
Yeah, basically. Which I think was actually really striking. People were like, well, if it wasn't your idea, whose idea was it? And what are you doing?
And in the background around that same time is when you find out that she and Dr. Luke had, you know, differences of opinion in terms of her career direction. And she had been preparing that lawsuit. So it was not long after that, I think, that it became public that she was claiming these things against Dr. Luke, which he has denied. He says, you know, this was an extortion attempt. Basically, mm-hmm. she wants out of the contract she signed, and she's going to burn it all to the ground, saying the worst possible things about me to get out of this. That's his version of events.
So before we get into the sort of legal back and forth, at that time, look, pop stars frequently sign contracts that are deemed usurious in some way and that they want to get out of. So from a distance, this didn't necessarily scan as different from other situations, but in what ways did it become clear quickly that this circumstance was not like the sort of average pop star pushback?
I think the severity of the accusations automatically made it a tabloid thing, right, where these are sort of salacious things and, you know, basically saying throughout my career, this person was horrible to me in these various ways. But also it sort of elevated her in a political sense. She became this sort of feminist icon where she was standing up and people, I think, were rallying behind her to say this is what women experience in the music industry since the beginning of time, mm-hmm. and yet we can never sort of stand up and have our voices heard in that way. And I think because, again, of that severity of that, there was no give on Dr. Luke's side either, because he was saying this never happened, and it instantly became untenable for them to ever come to any sort of agreement of how to move on from this.
Because one of them would have to cede.
Because one of them would have to say that they've been lying. Yes. Yeah.
And at that point, didn't also Lady Gaga at some point start to speak out against Dr. Luke? Am I remembering that correctly?
So there were some sort of vague acknowledgments from other women in the music industry of them raising their hand and maybe saying, I've had similar experiences, or I didn't like working with Dr. Luke either. There were no other
accusations.
Everyone
stopped short of accusing him of any sort of abuse, though.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Taylor Swift donated $250,000 to Kesha's cause, essentially to her legal fees and all that.
Right, because through all this, Kesha's contention is that she was unable to release music.
Yes.
And she could record it, but ultimately Dr. Luke had to sign off on it. And that was either not a position, not a conversation she was willing to have, or she was trying to have it. Was it ever clarified whether she was trying to have it and Dr. Luke was actually putting up a roadblock, or she just simply did not want to go down that road?
So this depends on who you believe, right? Going back to the court hearings, I think when people first started really following this case, Kesha was moving for a preliminary injunction, which would have basically prevented Sony and Luke from suing her if she put out music outside of her contracts. That was denied. Sony was in court then. Dr. Luke's lawyers were in court then. And they were basically saying, we want you to record. You can record. We're not stopping you from recording. We know your contracts say you have to work with Dr. Luke, but that doesn't seem tenable at the moment. So let's put you in the studio with other producers. We'll all sign off on it and your career can continue. She was saying that these companies have no incentive to promote her work if she's coming out against the boss, right, basically. So they're sort of in this stalemate where she wants to make music on her own terms, and they're saying, well, you can make music on our terms, but we'll keep Dr. Luke out of it. So it wasn't quite maybe what she was looking for, but eventually it became seemingly her only option. And I think that's how we begin to get to Rainbow and what became the album.
Because as recently as when at the time of that concert last year, she was still saying,
I can't release music.
Yeah.
Or even if she was, when she was putting things out online, maybe there were a couple things that were covers, like the early stuff that she was reintroducing herself with.
She did a song with Zedd, a cover of a Zedd song, and there was some back and forth of whether that was going to come out. It ended up coming out, but we hadn't heard any original music from her short of live.
And so let's talk about Rainbow. Let's play another song from Rainbow right now. Let's listen to Learn to Let Go. Been a prisoner of the past. We'll be back in a sec.
Popcast is supported by Stella Artois. This summer, which occasions do you think you can make truly unforgettable? The answer is all of them. Stella Artois believes that any moment is an opportunity to host one to remember, and that with great friends and Stella Artois, you can elevate the everyday to something extraordinary. Because no gathering of friends should be anything less than truly unforgettable. So, host one to remember, all summer long, with Stella Artois.
Penn State World Campus offers more than 125 graduate and undergraduate degree and certificate programs that you can work towards from anywhere in the world. Getting more info is easy. Visit worldcampusinfo.com. Penn State World Campus's convenient, flexible online format is a great option if you want to advance your career or start fresh in a new field. Learn how Penn State World Campus can help you reach your educational goals by visiting worldcampusinfo.com. Penn State World Campus, a world of possibilities, online.
Okay, and we're back. That was Kesha, Learn to Let Go. On Rainbow, there's, I would say, a couple of thematic through lines. Obviously, some of this music is about navigating against a difficult person in abstracted terms. There are no names being used, but sort of interpersonal struggles and overcoming people who seek to hold you back is certainly a through line on this record, with some combination of personal pain, but also hands off, like, not, I'm not going to deal with this, and I'm going to let you solve your problems, and I'm going to focus on mine. I found this record not as maybe as immediately engaging as the early Kesha records, but it certainly does highlight what's one of the things that Kesha is really good at. I think she's a very good songwriter. I think she's a good singer. I think she has far more eclectic taste than she could have been given credit for, given what her first couple of releases sounded like. And this feels like a record that is truer to the person we have come to know publicly in the last 4 or 5 years.
I think it's also age appropriate. Because it's easy to forget that when the first records came out in 2010, she was like 23 and she's 30 now. And if she was making the same kind of bratty party all night music, I don't even know that.
What are you saying about my taste?
I know. It wouldn't even jive.
And the maturity level.
Oh, my God. Listen, I'm TikToking as much as you guys are.
JDC young boy over here.
They sound like I'm 100 years old. I like the tickety talk guys, but it wouldn't even jibe with like the cultural moment. I mean, like, there's escapist music happening right now, but it is a serious moment. And she was recording this recently, and she's a politically aware person.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, heartened that I completely agree with you, but that for every serious song about, like, dealing with a serious issue or overcoming something, there was a really, really lighthearted song that updated the kind of playful, freaky vibe from the earlier records, just, like, a little bit more mature.
And I think we saw that on the Creepies tour as well, which the F the World tour, is that what it was called?
According to the New York Times.
She, you know, when she would play old songs, there was still sort of these theatrical, there was like a dinosaur head at some point. There was like some cannibalism.
Yeah, and the band was dressed in like a kitschy way.
I mean, but we all have to admit that was a very sad display. You know, my big fear going into listening to this record was that it was going to be a reflection of that show, which I did not enjoy at all.
That was a rough night.
It was hard because she was struggling. And at that show, I mean, I was really disappointed that whenever it felt like there was a creative struggle, she would just like turn on the dispute. Like, hey guys, really glad you could be here with me. She'd get a free Kesha chant started, and then everything would sort of like return to normal.
And I have to say, if we may not have been into the show, everybody else there was very into the show and supportive, you know, of her. They saw her as this as a cause. Yes.
It's a loyal fan base. I mean, people want her to succeed, which I think says a lot about the work she did on the early records. But I was really concerned that this record was going to be either super weepy. Like, John, I love the line that you wrote in that live review where you called it unfriendly rock, because that was exactly what I thought it was. She had stripped down her pop into something very strange and unfriendly. So I was worried it was going to sound like that. And I was worried it was going to be joyless. And I think she really, like, to me, the most important thing she did on the record was, like, find joy.
Yeah, it is. And even I will say, because, again, there are the two different directions on the
record. Exactly, yeah.
But even the direction that is the more emotionally felt, troubled direction, to me, still feel, I don't want to say joyful, but engaged in kind of this vibrant way.
Well, they're optimistic they're inspirational, I think, more than wallowing.
I think Learn to Let Go, the song that we just heard, is actually a great example of it. It's like, it's poppy. There's some like banjo plucking in there. It's a little bit of all her influences. But ultimately, you don't walk away from that song feeling sour. It's uplifting. She's like, you know what? I have to practice what I preach. I've been saying I need to get over this and get on with my life. And I'm going to, because like there's always another day. It's actually quite a beat.
Now, the sort of wrinkle here, right, is that when you hear this album and you see that it's released and you sort of take stock of where she seems to be mentally, and, you know, it's been successful so far. As you said, it probably debut at number one. Praying is, you know, has some legs as a single. It seems like she, on some level, was victorious over Dr. Luke. Mm-hmm. Now, the reality of the situation, a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. So can you talk about some of the sort of the continuing legal circumstances? Because we're not free and clear of those legal circumstances.
No, Kesha, you know, hashtag free Kesha, like Kesha is nowhere near free. Basically, yeah. She exists now under the same contracts that she did when this all began. Most of her legal claims against Dr. Luke have been thrown out. She has a few appeals pending and, you know, a few technical legal arguments that still exist. But now she's essentially defending herself in a lawsuit that Dr. Luke made against her for defamation and breach of contract, basically saying, you know, by her not putting out music for all those years, she was going against her agreements. And by saying that he was a rapist, she defamed his name. Now, Dr. Luke's lawyers are making the case that his work has essentially dried up because of all of this. It's been.
I think everybody can make that case.
I think if you look at the charts.
Although, to be fair, at least part of that is his day maybe has just passed.
Sure, that's totally possible. Yep. But he would at least, I think, be taking those swings. He hasn't, I think, had a top 10 record in almost 2 years now. The biggest single I can remember him working on of late was a Jennifer Lopez single that flopped and that she was criticized for having worked with him, mm-hmm. even though the demo, I guess, had been floating around for a while and it just ended up with her. Mm-hmm. She didn't work directly with him in the studio necessarily. But Kesha still could potentially be on trial for defaming Dr. Luke at the end of this. Meanwhile, the album came out on Kemosabe on mm-hmm. RCA. Luke's lawyers make the claim that she could have done this all along, that nothing changed, that, you know, she could have put out this album basically two years ago.
Am I right? Part of the original contract was that on any Kesha project, he would have to produce or write a certain number of songs.
Six songs in the contract. At least six Dr. Luke songs on every Kesha release.
And that part of the contract is not necessarily null and void now, but that he's going to get those points or that money is going to find its way to Dr. Luke some other way.
Right. Basically, he will try to get that money through damages claims in court as opposed to the equivalent of his producer rates for what would have been those songs.
Do we know how many more albums Kesha is attached to these contracts?
Two, I believe.
Joe knows.
Yeah, Joe knows. She's under contract for two more albums with Dr. Luke post Rainbow.
So let's go a little deeper into Rainbow, because it's, again, a more versatile approach and aesthetic than we've heard from Kesha before. But I think Karen and Joe, you're not allowed to agree because you're a reporter, but I think, Karen, you're not going to agree that we're grateful that it was not the aesthetic of the live show last year.
Yes.
What does Rainbow sound like, and who did she work with to make it sound that way?
It sounds like a bunch of things. You know, there's some of these grand, giant pop statements, which is sort of like Praying. There are two songs that are like, I consider this high praise, but Ashley Simpson-esque in that they're kind of like pop punky.
Wow.
I was slightly dismayed to learn that
all
Eagles.
The pieces,
I would happily. Podcast listeners, please email us because I will do an all Ashley Simpson podcast request.
We'll find an anniversary of the lip sync.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's just say that if we get, you want to say 20 emails?
Oh, low bar. But yes, if 20 of you.
No, I think 20 is like a fair number.
Wish for an Ashley Simpson
25?
Cast. I will.
All right, let's say 25. If we get 25 we'll emails.
Ashley Hive.
Yeah.
Where
seriously,
are you?
If we get 25 emails requesting an
Jig
all
Hive.
Ashley Simpson podcast.
Yeah, we'll make it happen.
Yeah.
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 But Bronx, anyways, Bronx Mowgli, you out there? You want to email yet? You want to holler at us? Okay. Yeah. So just as a sidebar, 20, yes. 25 emails. Yeah. Okay.
But that, I mean, Ashley Simpson was making records slightly before the time that Kesha came out in a mode that I was quite interested in. But two of these songs, we have to be true to ourselves, John.
I like the Ashley Simpson.
True to ourselves.
I'm
Madonna's birthday. Shout out Madonna.
True.
Just getting all of my stuff out there. So two of these songs with Eagles of Death Metal, I was... as collaborators, I'm not really sure she needed Eagles of Death Metal to make those songs, but she did. There's the title track I believe she worked on with Ben Folds, who was a sort of a confidant and collaborator during the Dr. Luke struggles.
There's a bit of
yes.
There's a bit of Ricky Reed on there, and he's
Ricky Reed definitely.
He's like a Swiss Army knife for pop stars. Mm-hmm. He's sort of in and around a lot of things that are
shouts
on the radio.
Shouts to Wallpaper. Seriously, Wallpaper, good record. Shouts to you, Ricky Reed. Really out here doing it.
And John, I believe that you might have opinions on another collaborator. His name is Ryan Lewis.
My guy. My bruh.
Previously close collaborator of Macklemore.
Is that true? Previously, yes. Perhaps once and perhaps future collaborator of Macklemore. It is, as a sidebar, striking to see that Macklemore without Ryan Lewis is not radically different than Macklemore with Ryan Lewis. I think the things that are different are interesting and actually positive, but it's not that different.
We're really at risk of going off topic here, so I'm going to pull it right back in.
I'm throwing that gem out there.
That gem
is also in the fall preview. When the fall preview comes out,
it's my
fault. Gem will already be in there. It's already in playlist.
I misspoke, but I do want to just point out that a collaborator on six of the songs is Kesha's mom, PB Siebert.
Is it Siebert?
How do you pronounce it?
I thought it's Siebert.
I think it's Siebert.
Okay. Pretty sure it's Siebert.
I think we're trying to French up.
You're co-bearing her.
So, Nashville family.
Yeah. All right. So.
The most striking of those songs is the one that she'd been a Nashville songwriter for a long time. I think a lot of people saw her trying to live through Kesha a little bit, you know, reinvigorate her career. Mm-hmm. But I liked all the songs she worked on the record. And they recruit Dolly Parton to duet with Kesha on one of these songs that was PB's sort of biggest hit. It's called Old Flames, parentheses, Can't Hold a Candle to You. Why don't we listen to that?
Yeah, let's listen to that.
Downtown tonight, I saw an old friend, someone who I used to take comfort from long before I met you. I caught a spark in his eyes, a forgotten desire. With a word or touch, I could have rekindled that fire.
So that version of Kesha that you just heard is, to be fair, the version of Kesha that she was always kind of contending was the true version of Kesha. And I won't necessarily say that she was contending that even, say, when I interviewed her in 2010 or whenever that was. But I think in the universe at that time, she was still saying, I'm this person. This is how I was raised. This is what I grew up on. And then I basically moved to L.A., took on these contracts, took on this new character, and I'm living this entire life, but this is what's always been inside of me. And so to see her returning to that, scraping away all the makeup, all the exterior shenanigans or whatnot, and to return to this sort of core self, I don't know, I find it compelling.
Well, also vocally.
Yeah.
I mean, that vocal performance is great. I mean, Dolly outsings her. Sorry, but it's Dolly.
Yeah, but that's Dolly.
Sure.
But she sounds amazing, and she really opens up and belts in the sort of Pink Kelly mode that she didn't really have an opportunity to do on those earlier songs where the production is very compressed and synthy, and she was really just sort of in this narrow sonic range.
And she was rapping.
Oh, she was rapping.
Also, the rapping.
I just want to say it's 2017 and she was rapping.
I think that there is one. I can't remember which song. There's a little rap on this record. Because when I heard it, I remember I would sort of like laughed myself. And I was like, ah, Kesha.
Right.
Still doing it. Thought of your piece.
Aww.
And just in a narrative sense, I mean, the fact that she is achieving this maybe truer version of herself, but ultimately still under the business umbrella of Dr. Luke, that just adds a whole other sort of layer of intrigue to this album, which I think...
But is that not a form of redemption?
Totally.
Yeah.
And, but I think, it's complicated.
It makes it a success, I think, on more levels than I was expecting.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I really do like this record.
Yeah, I think it's very strong. It doesn't feel as... It doesn't feel quite as sticky as I have come to ordinarily feel about Kesha records. Like, I feel that she had mastered, whether it was her or her and Dr. Luke together or whatnot, but she had mastered this kind of a very tactile, oddball pop affect. And this is not that. This is a more complicated, it's more nuanced. I think the highs are not quite as high. But the sort of emotional content is very consistent.
I agree with that, too. I also just was thinking about, like, how our ears have been trained to hear pop music so unbelievably differently in the time since those records
sure.
came out. You know, if you put on a Rain Spotify,
drop.
Well, whatever, any of the Spotify, you know, top America, top 50.
All my contracts are dead.
Yeah. It just doesn't sound much like this. I mean, I think production-wise, like, it was an attempt to make her sound updated, but it's not an attempt to make her sound like today. Silenced.
Yes,
that's good.
There is no comeback from that.
That's good.
One last thought from Kesha before we come back, and that's let him talk. Okay, so a little bit of a transition. Joe, earlier you had mentioned one of the curious turns that the Kesha circumstance had taken over the past few years, which is that at some point, Taylor Swift kind of emerged from the ether and gifted Kesha with $250,000. This is early in Kesha's legal troubles when she was being very vocal about the fact that she could not put music out.
Right. At her public lowest.
Yes. And she had no access to real capital, basically. Taylor Swift kind of comes out of nowhere. It was sort of a quiet period for Taylor, if I remember.
And it was quiet even after the gift because it sort of came via statement from Taylor's team. It was never, I don't think she's ever spoken on
publicly, herself.
Which is sort of interesting. And but you saw that sort of reciprocated then this week when Kesha tweets at Taylor Swift in support of her while Taylor was going through her own sexual harassment trial.
So for the last week and a half in Denver, there has been a trial for two countering lawsuits. David Mueller, who was a radio DJ in Denver, was suing Taylor, Taylor's mother, and one of Taylor's managers for the loss of income because he was fired from his job because allegedly, or at least prior to the resolution of this case, allegedly had sexually assaulted. Was that the charge?
Yeah.
She sued him for assault and
battery.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Taylor had contended that this DJ prior to a show had grabbed her bare ass during a photo op, basically like a backstage,
a meet and greet
where there's 100 people lined up for a 5-second photo op.
Should we all share our photos from the Taylor meet and greets?
I only have Brittany.
Taylor likes to meet and or greet.
I only have Brittany.
I never share such intimate things.
You can see me and Brittany. Go back on my Instagram. Yeah. quite a ways.
Yeah. He lost his job as a result of
Taylor's mother.
Taylor's mother,
what he had done.
To his higher-ups at the radio.
So the initial, she did not initiate these legal actions. He initiated the legal actions. She then sued him back. And there's no criminal, again, not a criminal charge, but sued him back for $1 was
a symbolic dollar,
but accusing him of sexual assault and battery.
And the jury found in her favor that she was assaulted.
Yes, this all was resolved in the last two or three days. So initially, his case against her, the first thing that happened was his case against her was dismissed by the judge for lack of
evidence. They dropped her from the case, but the—
her mother and that manager continued. Were still on the case. But the end resolution—
the jury found in her favor.
And part of the reason was because Taylor gave extremely articulate, sharp, bold—
and a little bit, like, funny.
Yeah, a testimony.
She called the lawyer by his first name.
Gabe.
Which is extremely badass. I didn't even know you could do that.
Seriously. Yeah. True story.
Rewriting the rules. So Melina Ryzik wrote a story for us this week saying that, you know, it was obviously a very closely watched trial, not just by fans of Taylor, but by people who have survived sexual assault and people who work with those who have survived sexual assault. And it focused largely on the language that Taylor had used, which was really, really direct.
She got up there and, you know, I think Taylor has had a rough few years maybe in the
public perception
in terms of her sort of persona outside of music.
Yeah.
A complicated relationship to feminism in particular.
Yeah, yes. I think since she made that part of her brand, you know, she's also come in for a lot more criticism about when she chooses to ally herself with other women, if she's trying to get ahead, if she's manipulative. You know, there are all these sort of ideas swirling about who really is Taylor Swift and is she a good feminist or not. And so it was interesting for me to see, you know, she just really knocks this out of the park. And I think even people who are skeptical of her motivations in general had to sort of tip their hat and say
she was very unequivocal and it was received in an unequivocal fashion.
Yeah. And I think in Melina's story, she wrote, you know, that there are sexual assault survivors and people who are considering whether to pursue legal or criminal action. And, you know, that this could be seen potentially as some sort of a blueprint for a way to be assertive about your experiences.
Yeah. In particular, because she was able to offset the blame and the shame that so much testimony when you're expected to testify about your own assault circles around, like, what you did to possibly invite this to happen to you, which seems insane.
There's no audio of the trial, but obviously there's a lot of transcripts of what was said. And one of the things that she, I think, returned to on a couple of occasions was that she will not be made to feel any kind of way about circumstances that arose from the decisions of somebody else.
Right. Yes. And you have the lawyer opposing counsel sort of saying to her, you know, why didn't you react more? Mm-hmm. Why didn't you stop the photo shoot? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And she sort of turns it back on him and says, why didn't your client take a normal photo with me?
Yeah.
Taylor obviously comes with a lot of built-in advantages, and she was even smart about getting ahead of those criticisms. Yep. I think her statement after the trial acknowledges that. Yeah, I have these privileges basically of having the money to fight this, of being, you know, a beautiful, famous young white woman. Mm-hmm. And she didn't say that in so many words, but that was
an extrapolation.
That was the gist. Yeah. Okay. She was saying, I know my advantages, but I hope that this can be an example.
There was no parenthetical that listed all of the advantages, to be fair.
Right. Yeah. But you know them.
Yes. We're all aware. And she also said that she'd be donating money to various charities who worked in this area. So rather than saying, I'm going to try to bankrupt this guy, I'm going to try to get $300,000 or $500,000 out of this trial and then funnel that money, she says, no, I just want $1 from this person because the victory is what actually counts. This victory is symbolic. And then I'm going to use my own resources as a way of furthering these causes.
And she's given language to people, you know, who might be doubtful about what to say in terms of their own assault. And she really, you know, it's funny because people sing her lyrics and she gets in your head. But I think, like, everybody has sort of memorized some of the lines from the trial.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Since she's made feminism part of her brand, you know, she's had a few missteps where, if you think back on the Kanye line where he says, me and Taylor might still have sex, and she sort of came out and wanted to make that something that to stand against. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in her Grammy speech for Album of the Year, she said, don't let anyone make you feel like they're responsible for your success or that you owe them anything. And even still, you would have the sort of backbiter saying, well, she's just doing this to get ahead. Obviously, Kim Kardashian, Snapchat, all that happened. Her beef with Nicki Minaj over the VMAs. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just been these sort of—
The Katy Perry conflicts.
The Katy Perry conflicts.
I wasn't
there's
even
going
to bring it up.
Missteps.
I know Karen takes that very personally.
I'm here for that.
But this one, it seems...
It's unambiguous.
Yeah. She won.
As meaningful as it was, the resolution of the Taylor Swift trial was not the most important news of the last week. These have been extraordinarily traumatizing times in our country. We saw what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend with the neo-Nazi and white supremacist demonstrations and the resulting chaos and deaths that took place. Music is, for a lot of people, a salve, and I think it could also be an incredibly powerful place to challenge and embrace ideology. And to close out podcast this week, I want to play a song that I was reminded of recently. Someone posted on Twitter, I think it was Milo, the rapper. It's a song that I remember from the 90s very well. And really, I think speaks as powerfully to this current moment as it did to when it was released. This is the Freestyle Fellowship, We Will Not Tolerate.
We will not tolerate beating, lynching, burning, raping, pillaging, drugging, mass murdering of blacks. We are not your O-R-D-I-N-A-R-Y-R-A-P-P-E-R-T-G-E-R-S on our chest is wickedness. The press is telling us lies. We will not tolerate white men, nor black men, taking them home, chopping their bones, and smothering them with plastic, and dipping heads in acid. Wonder if Dobbins dies.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thanks to my guests, Karen Gans and Joe Coscarelli. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, whether about Ashley Simpson or what you will not tolerate, at podcast@nytimes.com. Please subscribe at Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We're back next week.
Anticipate fate, liberate state of mind.